Well, can we start?
I'm at your service.
All right. It's good to have you here. It's many of us, as a post-adolescent, of course, I read Ayn Rand, was influenced by her, and that she helped to reconcile some of the conservative beliefs I had as a young man from the Midwest, very Republican family. There are things in conservatism that I didn't agree. I became, like you, I believe you stayed in Judgment Day, you became an atheist at the age of 12, and I became one at 13, long before I had read Ayn Rand. So she helped to do a lot for me as a young man. I'm not sure I would have liked her, though, as you depict her in the book. She was a rather severe woman. But a lot of younger people today may not know Ayn Rand, so why don't we just talk a little bit about her and your relationship with her. Who was Ayn Rand?
Ayn Rand was most famous, of course, for two novels that have sold in the many millions of copies. One is called The Fountainhead, and the other is called Atlas Shrugged. What was unusual about her, she wrote a great many other books, many collections of philosophical essays, was that she was both a novelist and a philosopher. And her novels, while terribly exciting and very dramatic, are nonetheless very philosophical. And she's always had an enormous appeal, especially to young people. I don't think you can go into any large-sized cocktail party and ask people what the name Ayn Rand means to them without finding many people who will not tell you that at some point in their development, this name was very important for their growth. And the interesting thing is it cuts across obvious intellectual differences. I can remember talking to a psychologist who was a socialist, but who spoke how important the Fountainhead was to him, giving him the courage to go his own direction, even though Ayn Rand was very far from being a socialist. She was, as you no doubt know, an uncompromising advocate of capitalism. I can remember a friend of mine interviewing quite a famous ballad singer in the 60s, I guess it was, and he was talking about he and his musicians resisting the tidal wave of rock and roll and preferring a more romantic kind of music and talking about getting courage from the Fountainhead. A few months ago, I was at a cocktail party in Los Angeles, and I met John Lilly of Dolphin and LSD fame, hardly a name you would associate with Ayn Rand. And within 5 minutes of talking, he's telling me stories about how important the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged was to him and giving him courage to pursue a path where many of his colleagues thought he was crazy. So people of all ages have felt themselves often empowered by her work, whether or not they shared all the details of her philosophy. I read The Fountainhead when I was 14 years old. I was deeply, deeply impressed by it. It became really the chief companion of my lonely, somewhat alienated adolescent years. I met Ayn Rand a month before I turned 20.
Let's go back to just a moment. You read The Fountainhead because you were a young man in Canada at the time. Why did The Fountainhead mean so much to you at that time?
There are two levels on which I can talk about my response to The Fountainhead. One has to do with literary matters of artistic style. The other has to do with content. Artistically, I just love the enormous purposefulness of the writing, the stylization, the complete, the romantic kind of a literary method which she was to call a romantic realism. She was dealing with real issues of real people in the real world, but the method was very stylized. It was very much not the folks next door, and that appealed to me enormously. On a concept level, what I was attracted by was the emphasis on individualism, on the importance of personal integrity, on work as potentially a heroic activity, and very important, this last point, the sense of life as a sacred mission. All of those elements were terribly important to me as a teenager, and now that I'm 59 years of age, they are still important to me.
Have you reread Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead of late?
Many times across the years, and I look at them somewhat differently than I did when I was younger, and things I don't like to the same extent that I liked when I was younger, and part of why I wanted to write the book was to clarify my shifts. But I think they are really extraordinary works of art nonetheless. And what's very interesting is that I was in a bookstore this morning, and the man to whom I was talking, manager, one of the salespeople, was saying that it's amazing that so many years later her books continue to sell quite actively in hardback as well as in paperback. In paperback, I know her titles sell better than 100,000 each a year, which is a lot for books 20 and 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And what's equally remarkable is the significant sale even in hardback of Let's say Atlas Shrugged was published in 57. That's more than 30 years ago. I've visited a lot of bookstores in the last couple of weeks in connection with the new book, Judgment Day, My Years with Ayn Rand, and I saw many times the hardback edition of Atlas Shrugged of the Fountain Head.
I recently tried to read Atlas Shrugged again, and I couldn't finish it. Ayn Rand had such a direct way of writing. There are no subtleties in her writing that I could see. She just slaps you in the face. And this book was very powerful to me as a teenager, or as a young man in my 20s, and meant a lot to me. But I found it hard going this time as an adult. I still have this fondness in the way I do in a way for nursery rhymes and children's storybooks. I mean, I'm attached to it. But I don't know that as an adult I could read it with any satisfaction today. But apparently you still are.
Well, I don't read it with satisfaction any longer, meaning I know the material too thoroughly, and it's too wound up with too many issues from my youth, so I'm hardly able to give a real objective response to what you're asking here. Too many issues.
You can't give an objective response?
I think there's enormous art in her writing. I have to say that I think that she is at times unnecessarily over-explicit, and that it would have been more powerful had she utilized greater subtlety and implication and thrusted the reader a bit more, and not, I would fault artistically a tendency toward over-explicitness, but I still think that as a stylist, as somebody simply who had a command of language, who could make you see whatever she wanted you to see, who could recreate sensory reality, she was really quite in a class by herself, simply in her what she could make words do. For example, her description of an airplane flight or the train ride sequence in Atlas Shrugged. I think it's simply dazzling literarily, the ability to create the sensation of motion or a flight and make you feel it as you're reading it. It's very hard art. Anybody who doubts it, try it sometime. Very tough art to do.
Well, you went to Los Angeles as a college student, and you wrote Ayn Rand a fan letter, which is how you happened to meet.
A month before I turned 20, in 1950. She was then 45, I was then 19, as I say, a month before I turned 20. I arrived at her home on invitation. She was impressed by my letter enough to invite me over. I arrived at 8 o'clock in the evening, and I stayed with her talking philosophy till 5:30 in the morning, and I really felt I had come home. I really had found my first place that felt like home, where ideas really mattered, where we could talk about the most serious issues, because there was almost no conversation that was frivolous in any sense, or even social. It was very, very, as I say, philosophical from the beginning, and I was so starved for that, that it was an absolutely great, great experience. And out of this, we became very good friends, she and her husband, Frank, and me and my girlfriend, Barbara, who I brought with me subsequently and who I had met because, and that's one element of the interesting plot of the story, who I had met because of her enthusiasm for the Fountainhead, you see. And we subsequently married, not happily, and that's part of the background to the events that develop in the story which I write about. But what interested me was the fact of the presence of this plot structure there from the very beginning. I mean, think about the fact you're 14 years old, you read The Fountainhead, this woman becomes your idol. She practically brings you up long distance. Your first marriage happens because you meet a girl who is introduced to you because of her enthusiasm for The Fountainhead. You subsequently become a close friend of this author who you have idolized. You become first a student, then a friend, then a partner, then a lover. And then, in the end, an adversary. So you were finally at a climax of your life, having to look at the fact that this woman who you have idolized all of your life now is mobilizing every resource she had to destroy you. Why? Because you have fallen in love with a young woman who has replaced her. And how do you meet the young woman? Because she has come to hear your lectures on the philosophy of Ayn Rand. That's plot structure. I would never have been perhaps interested to write this story except one day reflecting on it. It struck me, this all has the structure of a novel, except it all happened, it's all true. And I fell in love with the sheer drama of the story, and that's central to what I wanted to convey.
Yes, it is a drama, and also I think you, in a way, are obliged to tell your side of the story, at least to give your perspective Barbara Brandon wrote The Passion of Ayn Rand, which was a very good book. I interviewed her at the time of publication of that book. So it's good to have two different perspectives of essentially the same story. And, of course, in Judgment Day, you find contradictions with Barbara's account. So try to put them together, and I don't know exactly who's right. I can't remember all of the specifics. But let's go back. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, there aren't that many contradictions, actually, on the gross points. I'm telling another story exploring territory that Barbara wasn't in a position to write about, namely my intimate inside relationship with Ayn or later with Patricia. Barbara had wanted to talk to me about her book, and I explained to her that I wished her well, but that I couldn't, since I knew I was going to be writing this book, and I couldn't therefore give her the material that I wanted for Judgment Day. So although there are some points where we have a different memory of what happened, most people who have given me feedback have commented on the fact that on most of the main issues, at least in terms of gross outline, there is agreement. What is left out of Barbara's book is perhaps the surprise. The other elements that I think change your perspective of the meaning of the events rather than differences to she alleging this happened and I alleging this happened. That's not the nature of the collision.
Well, Ayn Rand moved to New York from Los Angeles and began work on Atlas Shrugged, and you and Barbara followed her east.
Just the opposite. She followed us.
Who did?
Barbara and I came to New York. Ayn had planned to remain in California until she finished the book. As she later told us, she got so lonesome for us, she changed her mind in three months and decided to follow us here to New York.
So she came after.
She came after us. Okay. We came in June. She came in October.
What? Now, you were a student at NYU.
I was studying psychology, and Barbara was studying philosophy.
And what happened during this period where you were a student and she began writing Atlas Shrugged?
She didn't begin it. She was in the last third of it.
Oh, was she?
Yeah. I began bringing some very interesting people who had admired her books and who I thought she would enjoy meeting and who I knew would enjoy meeting her, in the various intellectual professions, of which the most famous, perhaps, was Alan Greenspan, of course, who's our present chairman of the Fed. And we used to meet Saturday nights at Ayn Rand's house. We'd sit around, we'd talk philosophy. They were all reading various chapters of Atlas Shrugged as it was being written. And this was a great period for me. It was an incredibly happy period for me, because I had really created my own community of people who were bound together by a common enthusiasm for philosophy and ideas in general, and for these ideas in particular. And so it was an incredibly exciting period for me intellectually. Great conversations, great feeling of growing intellectually by leaps and bounds from month to month, except that at the more personal level, two things were happening. A marriage with Barbara, which should not have taken place in the first place, not faulting her, not faulting myself. It just shouldn't have taken place. People make mistakes, and God knows we did. And at the same time, the heating up of the relationship between Ayn and me, the intensity of the admiration spilling over and getting more and more personal and more intimate, until it began to change its whole form from becoming a friendship to beginning to show the signs of becoming a romance, which was rather shocking for everybody concerned, because I was what would be called in modern language a very straight young man, and I think we all basically were. And I had no premises whatsoever for dealing with this situation, except that a point was reached where, in effect, we declared our feelings for each other, Ayn and I did. We apprised her husband, Frank, my wife, Barbara, of the situation. And with some degree of stress and pain, an accommodation was made to the situation.
But common sense would have told you. You weren't that young that you couldn't realize that this was doomed.
I have two answers to you. Part of me agrees with you completely. Part of me wants to say that there are times when you meet somebody and a relationship could become so intense that maybe it has to result in a sexual encounter, but it's a great mistake to try to integrate it over time into your regular life and two other marriages without forecasting doom. And part of me says, yeah, well, so that was the mistake. But, you know, that's partly an American cultural issue, because some European friends of mine, they look at this whole thing very differently. They say, well, what was the big calamity. Meaning accommodations of that kind have been made all the time, and sometimes they work very well. It didn't happen to work for you, so you made a mistake. But it's not self-evident that anybody and everybody would have made a mistake by pursuing that course in that situation. It didn't work for you, and it would have been better if you had bailed out as soon as you saw that it wasn't working for you. A sentiment which I agree with, to say the least. But the fact remains that arrangements of this kind are made every day. And that they aren't talked about, and they aren't published in books.
Now, they're not made every day with someone like Ayn Rand. And the very nature, the very fact that as severe an individual that she was, and not just you, you might have been able to get away with it, and it might have ended peacefully, but Ayn Rand's character would not permit this.
There, if I understand you, I agree with you. You see, I'm assuming I understand you will proceed on that premise. You see, Ayn had a terrific need for control in any encounter. And I think this was at least one reason why she would attempt a relationship with a man 25 years her junior, no matter how gifted she may have thought him to be. The fact remains I was 25 years younger. Her husband was very passive compared to her. I feel that certainly it was in her power to have been able to see a little further into the future. And in a way she did in that. Now this is important. If you remember from the book, and this is identically covered both in Barbara's book and my book, originally it was thought of as a great exception to the flow of life that will be over in a year or two. It was never projected that far into the future. Once it began, then it all changed, you see. But that much sanity there was. There was originally the idea this will be a year, 2 years at the most, finished.
Oh, sure. That doesn't make sense at all. But, you know, Ayn Rand herself, I think, was culpable in this relationship even more than you. She should have known better. She was the leader of this group. She should have known better not to do this.
You know, when we have powerful unmet needs, we don't always bring our best wisdom to our choices, do we?
No, and she also was a woman, and in the way that we are men. I mean, she was a woman with emotions. There was apparently this strategy to create a goddess out of her, and maybe she even felt it herself, that she was not vulnerable to the needs and emotions that other people had. But she did have them, didn't she?
She did indeed, and she tended not to be in good contact with many of her own feelings and emotions. She prided herself that she knew herself very well, but in important ways she didn't. She really didn't. She was blind to a great deal. Because, you see, what made the situation onerous, and would have been onerous had she not been married and had I not been married, it still would not have worked over time. And this is very important in my view. You see, the issues between us embrace many more conflicts than just age. It's wonderful. See, the good news is you're 24 years old and this woman that you've idolized tells you, you are the embodiment of all the values that I write about. You are the apotheosis of my vision of man. That's pretty intoxicating stuff to tell a 24-year-old man. It's also a terrific burden to put upon a young person who's still in the process of creating himself. It's very seductive. And more as the years went by and her bitterness and disappointment with the world grew, what I heard more and more was, you are my lifeline to reality. You are all that makes life bearable. Now, that sounds at one level like an expression of love or appreciation, but at another level, however it's intentioned, and I won't speculate about motives, it's deadly in its consequences. Because we are not meant to be that one for another. We are not meant to make another person's life bearable. It leaves you very little breathing room. And I had very little breathing room. And I was sufficiently caught up in the situation to buy it and accept it. And I think each one of us has to take responsibility for our own choices in the matter. I feel quite strongly about that. So if you ask me, do I think I used good judgment? Absolutely not. Do I bitterly regret many of the choices I made? I sure as hell do. Do I think Ayn should have known better? I sure do. Do I see Barbara as a victim? Nope. I don't believe in victims in this situation. I believe that with whatever other, I believe there were mistakes, there was confusions. But there were a lot of rewards and payoffs for staying in that whole situation. It was very exciting. I'm not talking about monetary stuff. That's nonsense. I'm talking about the sheer intellectual excitement of being part of what we perceive as history, of being working with somebody that we thought was the great brain of the 20th century. And the pluses, and Barbara and I would talk about this, we were not insensible to the pain we often felt, but the bottom line was, it felt worth it.
Well, objectivism became your entire life.
That's correct.
Not only monetarily, but I mean, it dominated your life. All of a sudden, it stopped. She ended it. What happened there exactly?
Well, this is the climax, of course, of the book, isn't it? And what happened was that our relationship had kind of de facto come to an end romantically, not by conscious decision, but because she went into a bad period of depression following Atlas Shrugged, the publication, and Barbara and my relationship, well, we became better friends, paradoxically, as the years went by, and had a lot of affection for each other. It was just not working as a marriage at all. And in 1961, I was then 31, a young girl came to hear my lectures, and that was Patricia, who occupies center stage in the last third of the book. And over the next 3 years, against great resistance and with great agony and struggle and torment, I fell in love with her, and she with me, and had an affair. And when finally, in the climactic scene of the book, this is all presented to Ayn Rand, although there was a lot of build-up to it, which I'm skipping over for shortness of time, because I was giving Ayn a lot of signals that the romance is finished, and a lot of frictions and tensions were building between us long before Patricia entered Ayn's consciousness as part of the story. But the bottom line was that between being told that our romance was over and that I was in love with another woman, she decided that I'm a complete fraud, that I never meant any of my interest in philosophy, I never meant my admiration for her, I never meant my admiration for the Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged, and she must now proceed to destroy me. And so she does everything possible to prevent The Psychology of Self-Esteem from being published. She had introduced me to the publisher with whom the first contract was signed. When the book was too late, 2 months late, they made that the excuse to cancel the contract, which is totally unheard of for a book that's two-thirds finished, without the editor even asking to see me what I had written. I immediately found another publisher, and the book went on to be very successful, but that's a separate story. And we had created this nationwide, in fact, worldwide objectivist movement, and now the word was out. Nathaniel Brandon is anathema, and anybody who deals with him is dead, spiritually, as far as objectivism is concerned. And so now we get this great war, and it was very tragic. I remember one evening having dinner in a restaurant in New York with Patricia a few months after the break, and some waiter comes over to our table and recognized me, got tears in his eyes. He said, "What happened? My wife and I came to New York to study with Nathaniel Brandon Institute, and we just learned it's closed, and you and I and Rand are no longer together. I feel like my parents got a divorce or they died." I heard so many versions of this. Or years later, 12 or 13 years later, when I'd be publicizing a book of mine, I'd be on the road somewhere, maybe like this. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm here to talk about The Psychology of Romantic Love, a later book of mine, or Honoring the Self. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, in Cleveland, in San Francisco, in Seattle, somebody phones up and with great emotion says, "Whatever happened between you and I and Rand, I learned so much from both of you. You were my idols. What could have torn you apart?" My wife would say, "Why do they still care so much?" It was very painful, very painful. And what I wanted to write about in the book was this whole bit of intellectual history, but I wanted to write about it in a quite intimate and emotional and self-disclosing way, not as an impersonal history, but as a very, very personal history.
What happened to objectivism as a philosophy and indeed as a movement?
It has gone through several transformations. To begin with, as far as Ayn Rand's books go, they sell, and they sell, and they sell. It's quite amazing. There are probably more Ayn Rand study groups on universities in the USA today than at any time in history. The problem is there is no good leadership. So there's no center from which new ideas. It's all kind of reciting the catechism, reciting the old stuff. There's no serious intellectual growth. And therefore, there's a kind of an atrophy. It isn't that people don't read and admire the books, but it's not organized in a way that will attract new and good minds. So I don't like to see that. Nothing I can do about this. I don't feel it's my battle any longer or my concern, but watching it from the side, which I do, I would have to say that it's not moving as we had all hoped it would.
Are you an objectivist?
Not really. I mean, I kid and I say, well, I'm a neo-objectivist because I share certain broad fundamentals and I have rather important disagreements. So in a very general sense, if you talk about the supremacy of reason, if you talk about an individual's ownership of his or her own life and opposition to the concept of self-sacrifice, if you talk about uncompromising advocacy of individual rights and therefore a very limited view of government, in that very broad way, yes, I am. However, with every book I write, I become more aware of subtler issues where there are differences, chiefly of a psychological kind, chiefly omissions. You know, one of the greatest omissions morally in her books, I wouldn't fault this in a nonfiction book on philosophy, and I wouldn't fault it in a novelist. But she chose, which is very exciting, to use novels to exemplify a new morality. And nowhere in her writing is there any story that deals with the theme of moral redemption. That's very important psychologically. It's very important about her, and it's a terrible gap in the whole school. In other words, there is no example treated of a person behaving badly, doing wrong things, cleaning it up, and going on to lead a happy and successful life. Now, since in the real world, very few people manifest flawless integrity from day one till the last day of their life, the question of how you come back from moral error is a gigantically important issue for any system of morality to deal with. Now, one thing that the Catholic Church does that has a great lock for a great many people, they have a very big position on that, on confession and forgiveness and all that stuff. Never mind whether you agree with it or not, it addresses a very profound human need. Now, the need is legitimate. You may like the answer of one school more than another, but to have neglected, how I didn't see this in those days, I have no idea, because to me it seems so obvious today.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because
You get my point.
Yes, I didn't have the ability to understand or express it, but I think that's absolutely correct. That's one of the things I was saying on the outset of our conversation, the flaws in her writing, the lack of subtlety, but a lot of it is that lack of moral redemption. And in fact, Ayn Rand as a writer, or as a reader, Ayn Rand as a reader, you point out that she liked Mickey Spillane and Agatha Christie, and even her philosophy she got from you. She really didn't even read philosophy. One of the reasons Barbara Brandon failed as a novelist, as you say, that she wanted to be a novelist, she wanted to write. I'm sure she was intimidated by Ayn Rand's view of what fiction should be, and thus she couldn't write. You can't write the way Ayn Rand writes, and effectively, really. You can't write with someone standing over you. Ayn Rand would stand over Barbara, and she would want something to be in a certain way. Impossible. Impossible. Barbara was doomed from the start as a writer.
I think I have a paragraph in which I convey that in my book, and I agree with you completely. I agree with you. That's why I'm very interested to see what will happen now. Now a lot of years have gone by, and what Barbara will do next will be very interesting. I would love to see her do a breakthrough as a novelist, because that's really what she's wanted all her life.
Well, there's no reason she can't, and she writes very well.
Yes, she does.
The other thing that worried me about Ayn Rand, I mean, her taste in music. I mean, I don't think she liked objective music, whatever the hell that is. You know, music is music, and some of it is atonal, and some of it is difficult, and some of it is easy. But I mean, how can you or how can you establish objectivist art? You know, it almost sounds like the state telling you what art is preferable.
Well, no, because it's not an issue of being politically enforced, but I think that most well-worked-out philosophical systems will probably have a theory of art. And in that theory of art, they will suggest various criteria. They won't treat all alleged works of art as equal. After all, we all manifest standards of some kind. At the grossest level, there's none of us who would say there's no difference between good writing and bad writing. At some level, all of us apply standards. And anybody who has a philosophical viewpoint in the field of art probably develops, as she did, various criteria of what is literature, what is poetry, what is painting, and from analysis of what it is, can we get certain general criteria by which to ascertain what would represent a good fulfillment of the possibility of this art form and what wouldn't.
But why is Beethoven bad, and who did she like as musician?
Well, she liked Chopin very much. She liked Rachmaninoff. She liked certain other people. But she always said that there, she wasn't claiming that as a philosophical position. She said, since there is no objective theory of music, these were personal preferences of hers. She was not arguing for that on philosophical grounds.
But, you know, students of objectivism were intimidated by Ayn Rand and by yourself. And Barbara said something to me when we did the interview that she wasn't sure everything was right, but she spoke as if it was. And so the students believed it, or they were confused. They were baffled. And here, someone on high saying, this is the kind of music, this is my taste in music, and thus, philosophically, this must be correct. And they swallowed that. They bought it, didn't they?
In my book, I drew attention to the phenomenon that through the grapevine, people learned what all of her individual tastes, Ayn Rand's individual tastes, were. And although these individual tastes were not in writing proclaimed to be part of the philosophy in quotes, among the students they came to be regarded that way, do you see? In other words, she didn't, in her writing, convey a lot of the attitudes which she has become identified with, but they are very well known, like about Beethoven. And that happened through a grapevine, you see. It's almost as though, by analogy, you learned the Pope's personal taste in music. Now, it's not part of official Catholic doctrine, but for many of the true believers, it, for all practical purposes, becomes part of official Catholic doctrine, something like that. And there's no question but that I contributed to that process. I was a mouthpiece. I was a transmission bell. The truth of the matter is we all had certain differences in artistic preferences, but there was an atmosphere of wanting to get it right among the students.
Yeah, you know, you were younger then, and you weren't post-adolescent, but when I was a post-adolescent, I knew everything. I mean, you asked me about politics, I could tell you. You asked me about religion, I could tell you. And with each succeeding year, I found that I learned less. I know less today than my 21-year-old kid does. I am more confused about the meaning of life and not about drawing my own life and putting it in order necessarily, but just understanding things. Everything is so complex, difficult, that I learned less and less to make judgments. But when I was interested in Ayn Rand in those early days, I knew everything, and it had to be right, and it had to be correct. And I think this is a byproduct of youth, isn't it?
To some extent, yes, it is. I have to agree with you. Yes, it is.
See, you, here, you're 59 years old.
Yes, I am.
And you are not speaking in the dogmatic way that you would have as head of the Nathaniel Brandon Institute.
What you're saying is true, and I'm not trying to deny anything, but I will tell you an interesting story that I think might amuse you as an interviewer. Quite a number of years ago, when I was smack in the middle of all of that, I did one interview with Arlene Francis that I especially remember, and I was there to speak about objectivism. And she treated me very nicely, and I liked her a lot, and we got on famously. I did her show quite a few times. And one day when the show was over, I could see she was looking at me kind of quizzical or puzzled. And she says, let me ask you a question. She says, the ideas that you were expounding today, this was pure objectivism, right? And I said, yes. And she said that you and I and Grant are really in basic agreement. And I said, right. She says, this is so funny. She says, I was listening to you today, and what you were saying sounded really eminently reasonable and fair-minded to me. And I had her on the show some months ago, and she was saying things which, on reflection, I realized were not different from what you are saying now, except my teeth was on edge. And the point that she was making is that I didn't want to hear this at the time. I didn't want to hear anybody saying anything negative but Ayn Rand. But what she was trying to say to me, it took me around 10 or 15 years before I was fully willing to let in the meaning, was that Ayn was often her own worst enemy. She had a very abrasive way of communicating her thoughts, and that very often the same thought could have been explained in another way, not that would have won universal assent, but that would have elicited a less violent, not to say hysterical, reaction of hostility than it did. Not always, but often.
You point out in Judgment Day that when she made guest appearances at your lectures, she would often embarrass and humiliate her students or your students.
Yeah.
That's not not the way to do it. I don't think, I guess I would have wanted to have met Ayn Rand, but I think I would have been so intimidated by her and embarrassed by her, it's probably just as well that I had not. Well, this is it's a really interesting book that took me back to my youth, and I followed all of the events with regard to Ayn Rand and the Nathaniel Brandon Institute and the breakup and everything. So it was good to have this inside look at it, and it is a little bit of history that I think Ayn Rand will always be a historical figure, maybe not a momentous one, but she has a niche. She has a niche, and she's going to be followed for a long time, and you had a role in this. Very interesting book. Nathaniel Brandon, thank you very much.
Thank you.